You're listening to AM 580. This is a broadcasting service of the College of Communications here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. My name is Todd Gleason, in today for David Engine, who is away on Focus 580. Our guest today during this hour is Jeff Swearinger. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic here in Urbana-Champaign. Good morning to you. Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure, Todd.
A regular guest, so I suppose our listeners probably know a little bit about you and that they can call in with their questions about family practice to the station at 217-333-9455 this morning, or 800 if you're outside of the immediate local call-in area, 800-222-9455. That's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Jeff, let's talk a little bit about some things that might be of interest. We've had hot and cold spells and then back eventually to warm weather, maybe in
we
the
hope.
Next month or so. And I guess the first question I have, does that make much of a difference to human physiology and the way we get sick? And can we expect different sorts of things when we run from one temperature to the other as opposed to the slow kind of climatic changes we're used to?
Generally speaking, as long as people are appropriately dressed for the weather, it shouldn't really make any major difference in terms of disease exposure. The one thing that the relative cold snap here will probably delay is the onset of the allergy season. As the initially the trees come into bloom and bud, a fair number of people whose springtime allergies start to flare up will at least get a brief reprieve until things warm up again.
I want to come back to the allergies because that might be a good topic to take up and how those who are listening can handle those as they head into that. The other thing is that I'm wondering about children and age groups headed to school at this time of year. Often get excited about the warm weather. They're willing to wear shorts and T-shirts in 50-degree weather, 45-degree weather.
There are a few golfers out there doing the same thing.
Yeah, does that make much of a difference as long as they're comfortable?
No, generally not. As long as they're comfortable and are otherwise not, you know, exposing themselves to extremes of temperature for a prolonged period of time, it's generally not a problem.
And so just listen to your child and let them dress appropriately so that they're not cold during the day.
It was once said that a sweater is an item of clothing that a child has to wear when his mother is cold. But most kids are smart enough to figure out if they need to put something else on.
All right. Time to take some phone calls. They've already lit up the lines. We have someone on line four on a cell phone. Good morning to you. I have a question for Dr. Jeff this morning.
Hi, yes. I have a question. I just want to know, I'm a student and I study at Indiana University, and I usually have long studying sessions where I'm unable to eat the right foods, and I take vitamins. Do you have any suggestions of vitamins? I tend to get sick when I don't have a lot of sleep in me and the right type of foods. Or do you have any suggestions of other types of things that could possibly give me a quick cure?
There really is no substitute for sleep and food. A vitamin will replace some of the trace elements and minerals if you're taking a good general multiple vitamin once a day, but that in and of itself is going to be inadequate to meet your needs. In the short run, some of the protein supplements, the Ensure, Sustacal type of products could be used as a substitute for a regular diet, but there really isn't going to be anything that substitutes for sleep. You can sort of overdo it with caffeine temporarily, but you're going to find that your ability to concentrate is going to significantly decline. So ideally, if you can, try and plan your study week so that you can work in a little nutrition and some sleep and not try and save it all for the very end, though I know that's hard to do when finals come up.
And then I also have another question. I noticed that a lot of them have zinc in there. Does that do any help to the body? Like, what does that do exactly?
Zinc is thought to be associated with improvement in the immune system. Now, in most instances, there aren't many people who are actually deficient in zinc, assuming that they're otherwise eating normally. So how much additional benefit you get from what's in the vitamin is really still questionable.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for that call. One quick question out of that. I'm a motorcyclist, and yes, I always wear my helmet.
Good for you.
I think everybody should.
Good for you.
I think it's a bad thing if you don't. That's my personal views. Don't call in. And
it's not the official view of the station? Is that what you're telling us?
It's not the official view of the station. It's not the official view of the state either. But I've got a question about that. Some of the guys, when we long-distance ride, want to power nap. I tell them no. I'm guessing that some of the students actually do this as well. They try to power nap, which is to take a 15 or 20 or 25 minute or even an hour nap and then just keep going. Good idea? Bad idea? Does it work?
It does work for some people. And it's very individual, however, as to whether that's going to work for a given person. But for the individual who has found for themselves that that works, it's perfectly okay. Now, there is a limit to how far you can carry that. But on a temporary basis, even brief periods of good relaxation and rest are in fact, beneficial.
Listeners, we're talking this morning with Jeff Swearingen, doctor at Carl Clinic here in Urbana today. And if you have calls for him, you can give us, or you have questions for him, you can give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We have a listener who's been patient on line one from Urbana to talk to us this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning, doctor. Could you tell me what you'd recommend if we suspect our child has Asperger's syndrome, which is a kind of a subset of autism, and there's a group on campus, support group, but we need to get it diagnosed or assessed, and I'm a little confused about the difference between those two terms.
Well, as you point out, Asperger's is indeed considered to be a subset of autism, which is thought, in terms of the Asperger's, to be milder than the sort of full-blown cases of autism. The difficulty lies, in fact, with the diagnosis, since there is no blood test, there is no X-ray, there is no biopsy of something that you can do and say, aha, this is it. Most of these diagnoses come as a result of observation over time, the elimination of other medical diagnoses through the kinds of testing that you can do. But in terms of evaluation, you're usually looking at a child psychologist and some formal psychometric testing and perhaps a review by a good developmental pediatrician. But there is no one specific thing that's going to be able to say, yes, this is what the diagnosis is. And it really is more of the observation of the child's behavior and progress over time that sort of leads to the conclusion that this is what it might be.
Can you point to resources or possible places in town where we could get that done?
Yes. The Pavilion has a child psychology department that does some of the psychometric testing that's involved with this. Several of the pediatric neurologists at the clinic can do initial medical evaluations. And there is also a developmental pediatrician available at the clinic as well, Dr. Morton. And those folks, upon referral from your primary physician, could certainly sit down with you and your child and run through what the evaluation would be.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the group on campus, I assume, that he was talking about is The autism program at the autismprogram.org, if you're interested in seeing that website. To Aaron Abata, who I work with, I work for University of Illinois Extension in the College of ACES, the Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, and so does Aaron. Aaron is one of the contacts if you're interested in talking to Aaron Abata. His last name is E-B-A-T-A. We have a phone call now on line 2 on a mobile phone. Good morning to you. Do you have a question for Dr. Jeff this morning?
Good morning. I do. Thanks so much for taking my call. I have a 2.5-year-old who a couple of weeks ago was diagnosed with her first ear infection. And I have read a great deal about limiting the use of antibiotics in ear infections, and I know that some of that research is probably controversial, too strong a word, but there are a lot of different schools of thoughts out there. So I went to the first appointment prepared as a mother to hear, no antibiotics, let's watch and wait. And they did treat her with antibiotics, even though the pediatrician thought that the ear infection was pretty mild. We went back, and it had been a couple of weeks, and she was still fairly congested, and I thought a little uncomfortable. So I went back for a follow-up, and again, as a parent, thought, okay, we're going to walk in, and I need to be prepared to hear no antibiotics. And she was prescribed a stronger antibiotic, even though the pediatrician, again, said, gosh, I don't think that this is very severe, but, you know, let's go ahead and just treat this with a stronger antibiotic. So I guess my question for you is, as a parent, how do I kind of navigate that process? And when do I say, or do I ever say, gosh, I don't think an antibiotic is necessarily appropriate? Because I was really surprised after everything that I had read that automatically we were prescribing an antibiotic for an ear infection that was, you know, mild to moderate. So I would be happy to hang up and listen. And again, I know there are a lot of schools of thoughts, but I would love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I'd be happy to comment, and I'm actually very impressed to hear your point of view, because I would have to say that your physician is probably used to the other 99% of patients who come in expecting an antibiotic when, in fact, it may not be necessary. As you mentioned, this is an area of great debate. In the European medical literature and practice, they in fact don't routinely give children antibiotics unless there is persistent pain or fever beyond 48 to 72 hours. The majority of ear infections that we see are probably related to viral illnesses, or even those that are related to bacterial processes will probably be self-limiting. So the current discussion about guidelines is to say, if a child has a slightly red ear, no significant fever, no significant pain, the eardrum's not ruptured and draining, it is probably reasonable to simply observe that for a couple of days and see if the body itself and its own immune system doesn't take care of that. You can always, if things aren't going well, then add in the antibiotic if it's thought to be necessary later. You ran into a fairly common situation, which if you're treating an underlying viral process with an antibiotic, it's not going to get any better. Basically, viruses don't respond to antibiotics, so there really isn't any reason to think that that's going to make much difference. And unfortunately, the assumption then becomes, oh, it must be a type of bacteria that's not susceptible to that particular antibiotic, so I'll pick a different antibiotic, something stronger with broader, and you can sort of get sucked down a different pathway. Now, certainly with a child who has underlying growth and development issues, immune problems, some other reason to think that they're going to be more susceptible to bacterial infections, you would want to be a little bit more likely to prescribe antibiotics. But an otherwise healthy child with no pre-existing medical problems, especially if the ear infection seems to be associated with a cold, then it's perfectly reasonable the first few days to simply observe that. If there's persistent pain, fever, antibiotics may indeed be necessary. But a large number of studies where they've actually collected fluid from inside the ear have revealed that these are viral processes, and as such, they're simply going to run their course. It's simply part of the cold.
Well, let's go on. If you have questions, you can give us a call at 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's stay with this subject just a bit and talk about some of the medicines that our children do take for ear infections in particular and other things. Do you, if you go down this other route in particular and you start taking a series of antibiotics, what kind of problems potentially does that cause? And I guess if you run into a resistant one, how does the doctor know?
Basically, unless you actually have a clinical sample of fluid from the ear, you don't know. You're basically going on the clinical response. If the child takes an antibiotic and, you know, 2 weeks later they say, you know, I feel fine and their ear looks normal and their hearing's good, you say, okay, you know, it either got better on its own or it got better as a result of the antibiotic. And the flip side is true. If you look at it and it's not any better, you either say, well, maybe it's not a bacterial infection, or perhaps it's a bacterial infection that's resistant to the particular antibiotic that I'm using right now. So then you might switch to a different antibiotic. All medications with effects, which is what you're hoping for, have potential side effects, which you obviously hope you don't get. So any prescription medication taken can potentially have problems. With antibiotics, the most common problems with kids are generally stomach upset. The nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, secondary to the medication, is not necessarily an uncommon side effect. Rashes, some of which are allergic, some of which are not. There's also a concern that you are exposing bacteria to antibiotics that they will then become resistant to, that you're actually contributing to the process of more bacteria becoming resistant to antibiotics, which simply makes it tougher than when you do need to use antibiotics in the future. The other problem that people need to be aware of is that mechanically, there are a number of reasons why you might have fluid in your ear. A cold with a lot of nasal congestion will block the eustachian tube. Seasonal allergies will do the same thing too. And these can all then result in symptoms in the ear, not all of which are necessarily bacterial infections.
Why does it say take it even if you start to feel better?
The concern there relates to antibiotic resistance. If you don't kill the entire population of bacteria, the ones that do remain are the ones that are more likely to become resistant to the antibiotic. So the idea is to, if there are bad bacteria there, you want to kill them all and not give them a chance to develop resistance to the antibiotic.
Is there a difference between the name brand and the generics on the antibiotics at all?
Once a prescription medication has been approved by the FDA to go generic, they have to show that the efficacy of the medication is the same as the original name brand product. So generally speaking, there really isn't any difference. The major difference is really in terms of the price. The prescription medication is on patent, and the company can charge pretty much whatever it wants to for it. Once it goes off patent, then any other drug company can make that chemical product, and usually when the supply increases, then the price drops.
As we've said this morning, we're talking to Dr. Jeff Swearingen of Carle Clinic. If you have questions, give us a call at 333-9455 locally. It's a 217 area code, 800-222-9455. If you're outside of the area, we have someone waiting patiently on line four this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And your question is?
My question is, we have been down in Arizona for 3 months. We're heading back to Buffalo, New York right now. And I heard on one of the morning TV shows about the product Airborne that, you know, taking it regularly to try to prevent colds and so on can actually do more harm than good. And I don't remember all the facts and why that is true.
I'm afraid I'm just not familiar with that particular product, and consequently I can't say much about it one way or the other.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you much for the call. I'll take a look and see if I can find something out about it very quickly. And otherwise, we can go on and talk about a few other things. We have been talking about children just a bit. What are your views on kids and sports? There's awful lot of folks that are out there that have 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, mm-hmm. Sometimes younger, that are involved in sports. I'm probably as guilty as anybody. So I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, I think for kids, sports should be fun. Certainly in the United States, encouraging children to be and remain physically active, I think in the long run, is extremely beneficial. As many folks have probably read, we're sort of being inundated with problems related to obesity. And a lot of this simply has to do with excessive caloric intake and lack of physical activity. So in general, physical activity, I think, is a very positive thing for kids to be involved with. On the other hand, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be, you know, enrolled in a league that practices 7 days a week and, you know, travels year-round and that sort of thing. I think sports for kids should be something that they enjoy, get some pleasure from. If they are interested, want to develop their skills further, I certainly, you know, wouldn't discourage that. But there really isn't any good medical reason to push kids into activities that they either don't enjoy, or if they do repetitively, can actually, you know, cause some mechanical problems. You know, Little League elbow is named for a condition that comes as a result of some kids simply trying to do too much at too soon an age. But in general, I'm strongly in favor of kids participating in any kind of physical activity that allows them to get some cardiovascular fitness and hopefully establish patterns of behavior that they'll carry into adulthood as well.
What age groups are okay to start, for instance, full contact football, wrestling? I don't know, different sports, you have different views on different sports as
A lot simply depends on the physical maturity of the child. And that's why, say for football, there is the, you know, the 12-year-old who, you know, would get blown away in a stiff gust of wind. And then the other 12-year-old who, you know, you asked him where he parked his car and, you know, why didn't he shave that day? Those kids shouldn't be playing against each other on the same team. So in reality, it's not so much an age as it is a physical development stage that needs to be looked at, so that kids are playing against opponents that are roughly their same size.
We have a question on line one this morning for Dr. Jeff. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you could shed some light on the latest thinking on triglycerides. And is it my imagination that, you know, this process of thinking about cholesterol, triglycerides, and so on, is pretty much constantly evolving? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
You are exactly right. Just as in all areas of medicine, our knowledge is just that, constantly evolving. And it becomes confusing for folks in general, and physicians aren't immune from that. As new information comes out, perhaps some of the things that we were, you know, thinking and doing previously don't turn out to be as beneficial as we thought. As I tell some of my patients, life is an experiment, and we don't know how it's going to come out until the end, but you have to make decisions on a daily basis, and unfortunately, you make them with the information that you have available to you at the time. And with cholesterol and triglycerides, both, these are fatty substances that circulate in the bloodstream. Both have been associated with the development of cardiovascular disease, cholesterol much more strongly tied than triglycerides. But triglycerides in and of themselves have separate potential medical downsides, the most notorious one being pancreatitis. People who have markedly elevated levels of triglycerides are at risk for pancreatitis, separate from their cardiovascular risk. So in general, it's still very reasonable to try and lower your triglyceride levels if they're quite high. What people need to understand is that from a dietary standpoint, it's generally foods that are different than cholesterol. So when people say, well, I'm following a low cholesterol diet, how come my triglycerides aren't any better? We need to point out to them that it's really sugars, alcohol, simple carbohydrates, things that are rapidly converted internally to glucose or sugar, are the dietary sources for triglycerides. And that's actually different than the fatty substances that we think about with cholesterol. There we're thinking about the red meats and the fried things as the source of cholesterol. And so people really need to look at their diet differently if they're going to try and lower their triglycerides. The other thing that they need to understand is that most of the cholesterol-lowering medications are not necessarily specific for triglycerides either, and that somebody with a triglyceride problem may indeed be on a medication different than somebody on a cholesterol medication. But it's not uncommon for folks to have a problem with both. But you can indeed either dietarily or genetically have a problem with cholesterol or triglycerides or both.
We're about halfway through the program, 32 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock Central Time. You're listening to AM 580's Focus 580 on WILL Urbana. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen of Carl Clinic Family Practice here in Urbana-Champaign. Last Thursday, the CDC released a report that said one in seven Americans exercises enough and eats enough fruits and vegetables. The rest of us, well, not so lucky out of that number seven. So we're not doing so well in the United States.
We are pretty much a victim of our own successful economy and lifestyle. We basically don't have to do as much physical work as was required in the past. And we actually have access to, at a very low cost, more calories than most of us really need on a daily basis. And unfortunately, human nature sort of being what it is, you eat more, don't have to pay much for it. You don't have to physically do much. And the net effect is that problem we mentioned with obesity, which is also then tied to other medical conditions such as the increasing rise in diabetes, high blood pressure. These things all constitute some of the known cardiovascular risks. And in the United States, cardiovascular disease for individuals over the age of 40 still remains the leading cause of death. And comparing our country to, you know, the rest of the world, we have way, way, way much more cardiovascular disease than everybody else. And this is probably at least partly to blame for it.
And so we need to eat better. What's the difference maybe between the exercise regimen that a 40-year-old might need as opposed to a 50-year-old and a 60-year-old and a 70-year-old, if there is any?
I think the level of intensity that the younger adult can achieve is probably easier, but otherwise the time spent is usually still recommended to be about the same, which is at least 30 minutes, minimum of three times a week. I think for individuals who remain physically active, you know, the person who, you know, mows their own yard by hand, the person who takes care of a big garden, the person who likes to, you know, hike and hunt kind of thing, is probably working a lot of those activities into their daily routine. The individual who, you know, makes a point of walking to work and going up and down the stairs every day as opposed to, you know, driving in and taking the elevator, is actually building that degree of exertion into their daily activity, and as such, they may not need to do a formal exercise program, but certainly for individuals who aren't getting any other activity, doing something aerobic, basically getting your heart rate up enough to the point where you feel a little short of breath, where it would be a little hard to carry on a conversation, and being able to maintain that for for 30 minutes would be the ideal way to try and maintain some cardiovascular fitness. That needs to be coupled with attention to diet in order to keep weight down, but that's going to have benefits in keeping your blood pressure down. It'll tend to keep your blood sugar and your cholesterol down as well, and people in general should, one, be a lot healthier, and two, my experience has been is that most people who remain physically active feel better, both mentally and physically.
We have a caller now joining us from Line 1 here in Champaign. Good morning to you. I have a question for Dr. Jeff this morning.
Yes, I do. Thank you. Earlier, you were talking about children and antibiotics with ear infections. My daughter also was recently put on a broader spectrum antibiotic to help clear that up. Now I am interested in repopulating the good bacteria in her intestines because antibiotics kill off everything, is my understanding.
Correct.
What's the rule of thumb? How long do I give her probiotics?
Generally speaking, within a few days, after finishing the antibiotic, reintroducing any type of natural bacteria should colonize the gastrointestinal tract within a very short period of time, just a matter of a few days.
Okay, and with just normal yogurt with 4 to 6 different varieties, would that be sufficient?
Yes, it would.
All right, thank you very much.
Is that necessary?
In most individuals, it's not. But one of the complications of antibiotic usage is, as we mentioned, some of the gastrointestinal side effects, especially diarrhea. So if a child would have persistent diarrhea even after stopping the antibiotic, that would be a reasonable way to try and repopulate the normal bacteria in the intestinal tract. There is one fairly severe complication of antibiotic usage called pseudomembranous colitis, and these individuals can become really quite ill, primarily as a result of the dehydration that comes from pretty nasty diarrhea that is antibiotic-related. And that simply results as an overgrowth of the other bacteria that are sort of let loose when your antibiotic kills off the normal healthy bacteria in your intestinal tract.
We have somebody on Line 4 with us this morning as well, calling in from Effingham. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I was wondering about what would cause chronic drainage of the nasal? Would that be something that would be cause of you're allergic to something, or what would be the cause of that? Could you explain that?
That would be a very common explanation in many individuals who have environmental allergies. The allergic response in the nose and the sinuses generates quite a bit of mucousy discharge, and either avoiding what you're allergic to or blocking the allergic response with antihistamine type medications or some of the nasal steroid sprays are used for treating allergies. This would probably be the most common cause for that. The other reason that we see people with chronic drainage is sometimes related to physical or anatomical abnormalities in their airway. Somebody with a badly deviated nasal septum may indeed benefit from having that fixed. So there are some mechanical processes as well. But if it's truly an ongoing problem not associated with fever, then it's probably not an infectious cause. And either the mechanical causes with disrupted airflow through the nasal passages or environmental allergies would be the most common explanations.
Okay, I'll follow up on that. Would you advise someone to go see a nose, throat, and specialist?
It depends on the nature of your symptoms. If by the history it sounds more allergic, they're basically going to tell you, well, get your allergies treated before you come back in. So I wouldn't necessarily start there. Your personal physician would be a very reasonable place to at least initially listen to the full details of your history, do your physical exam, and determine whether either a trial of medication or formal allergy testing or an ear, nose, and throat consultation would be most helpful. It's a little difficult, over the radio to figure that out now for you.
So So, in other words, you would say probably chest for allergies, first thing.
That would certainly be a reasonable thing to do before entertaining any type of surgical approach, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have another call as well to join us this morning. Line 1 from Champaign. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm that 50-year-old guy that's having a hard time maintaining the amount of intense activity I used to, largely because of exceedingly thinning cartilage in my knees. I find that if I get excited in a workout and do what I used to do, I pay for the next 3 to 5 days with real difficulties. My question generally then is, short of surgical options, which apparently I ruin my future, are there any supplements like the glucosamines and these kinds of things that are agreed to have good effect?
You raise a very good question. The glucosamine has been looked at, and the results have been somewhat conflicting. There have been some studies that have suggested that up to 50% of individuals may develop some joint benefit as a result of taking glucosamine. Some of the more recent studies have suggested, nah, probably not. Because it's not a prescription medication, because it doesn't have a lot of potential to interact or cause problems with anything else, I tell my folks that I think it's a reasonable thing to try. But as a general rule, you're looking at taking glucosamine anywhere from 4 to 6 months at 1,500 milligrams a day to get that effect. It's not something you can take for a week or two and say, gee, I don't think it helped. That's simply an inadequate trial of the supplement. So I think for individuals who are in your particular situation, which I have to say is really quite common, basically you've noticed that there aren't many, 70-year-old marathon runners, primarily because their knees give out. And for most individuals who want to stay physically active, in many instances, they're going to just have to do something different. They're not going to be able to run 5 days a week like they used to. They're going to have to take up biking. They're going to have to take up swimming. They're going to have to start taking an elliptical trainer to use instead. And you basically are going to have to just, pay attention to the amount of wear and tear that you're getting in your body. But certainly the glucosamine is a reasonable thing to try, but you need to use it for 4 to 6 months and then decide whether you think it's worthwhile continuing or not. Certainly simple analgesics on a temporary basis, some Tylenol, can be in the short run helpful. And as you pointed out, then in the long run, if a joint really is mechanically worn out and a significant source of discomfort, then some types of surgical procedures are reasonable to consider there.
Is it, could I follow up?
Yes. Go right ahead.
Is it a fair schematic model then to feel as though if you, and I have not decided that my joints are mechanically going out the window on my own. A doctor showed me some pretty convincing x-rays. Is it a pretty fair model then to view your cartilage, your knees, as tires with a limited amount of rubber left on them in their natural life, and that therefore, if you really like the car, you'd be best to not do that repetitive activity that you've been honing for many, many years, or realize that there, you've only got so many bullets left in the gun there. And in other words, that when you're younger, you believe that the more you do, your body will respond and get better and better and stronger. But in this case, are the knees sort of like an ice cream cone that's melting, and if you do a lot of hot activity, you're going to make them melt faster?
Well, people mistake the training effect on their muscles, which, as you mentioned, is correct. If you use those muscles, you build them up and you get stronger. Cartilage is not muscle. It does not get stronger. It simply wears over time in proportion to how much physical pressure is placed against it. With the glucosamine, you're hopefully trying to produce a milieu that allows for the cartilage to slowly restore itself. but it's, you know, it's iffy. And so for individuals who are starting to really get a lot of wear and tear, we basically tell them, yeah, we want you to remain active. We want you to get the cardiovascular benefits of exercise, but you're going to have to find something different to do to take some of the pressure off of your knees. And that's where, you know, biking and swimming and the elliptical instead of running comes into play.
And maybe one last follow-up. I notice beyond just activity, sleep deprivation and fatigue and or cold weather seem to be really exacerbate the situation. Why is it that the fatigue and the weather come into play?
The fatigue makes everything feel worse in general. The cold weather is actually a mechanical process where the joint fluid doesn't liquefy quite as well. If you think of what happens to your diesel car in the winter, the fuel kind of gels, and it takes a while for it to literally warm up, thin out, and then circulate more smoothly. And the same thing happens to the joint fluid. It basically gels in colder temperatures and takes longer to reach a consistency where it lubricates better.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for your call this morning. We have someone on line two as well, calling in from Champaign. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about cholesterol and tris. Hello?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I regularly have a reading once a year in the 230 to 240 reading for cholesterol, and I always get hassled because I have what is supposedly now too high. But my HDL runs at about 96. My LDL is now over 100, so that's higher than it should be. But altogether, through the years, I've had very low risk factor because of the HDL. What do you think about that?
I wish I had yours.
But should I? I mean, I get hassled about this all the time. Should I worry about it?
It depends on the other risk factors that you have. Basically,
low blood pressure, by the way.
If your blood pressure is normal, if you don't smoke, if you don't have diabetes, if you're physically active and exercising without symptoms, you don't have any odd family history of premature death due to cardiovascular disease, and in fact, if you go down the whole list and the only thing that you have is this mildly elevated cholesterol with a very high HDL, which is your good cholesterol, I'd be very happy with that personally.
Okay. So I don't want to take the medication unless it's really necessary.
You know, this is a situation where, you know, if you want to do something, maybe to make your doctor happy, you can say, oh, well, I'm taking a fish oil supplement. You know, I'm having oatmeal every morning. You know, I'm doing some of the dietary things that, you know, are beneficial for my cholesterol. But in my opinion, with the information you've given me here so far, I would not treat that with a prescription medication.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're wrapping up our time. Maybe 10 minutes left to talk to Dr. Jeff Swearingen this morning. We're wrapping up our time. Maybe 10 minutes left to talk to Dr. Jeff Swearingen this morning here on Focus 580. If you'd like to do that, you can call us at 333-9455. That's a 2177 area code, or 800-222-9455. Dr. Jeff, why is it important for me to wash my hands?
Because that is the most common way for diseases to be spread. They've actually done extensive studies in hospitals where obviously people come in with, you know, fairly nasty infectious diseases, and they still find to this day that the number one way of preventing the spread of infection is for simply everybody to wash their hands thoroughly. And we make a point of doing that between every patient encounter, and it is still the number one way of trying to prevent that. And in the general public, you know, if you come in contact with other individuals, if you're out in public, you know, grabbing handrails and, you know, doorknobs and all that sort of thing, it's just a very prudent thing to do to, you know, wash your hands before you eat, before you put your hands to your own face, because this is really where a large number of the infectious processes come from.
Here at the university, and those who work here probably are familiar with this, last fall we were all given in preparation for the cold and flu season this past winter, the antiseptic, non-water antiseptics that you just squeeze onto your hands, those work okay?
Actually, not as well as just soap and water, because it's really not the fact that you know, you're using something antibacterial. To a large extent, it's the mechanical scrubbing of your hands that's beneficial in terms of dislodging bacteria that are on the surface of the skin. So I don't tell people that they need to do anything, you know, really expensive. They just need to be thorough about washing their hands
the
and mechanically scrubbing.
But the rinsing away is the important part, I suppose, at that point. Because if you just put the antibacterial
right.
on, it sort of stays there.
Right.
Okay. Line 4 has joined us on the toll-free from Bloomington, Illinois. That's line 4. You have a question for Dr. Swearinger?
Yeah, another cholesterol question.
Sure.
I read somewhere that nitric oxide metabolism is involved with cholesterol, and there are supplements that can help that. Are you familiar with any of that literature?
Only vaguely. You're now out into the sort of biochemical research area. I'm not aware of anything generally available yet that directly impacts that system. So you're correct. Nitric acid has actually been implicated in the biochemical processes for a number of things that go on in our body. But where it fits with cholesterol yet and what you can do about it, I think is still to be determined.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. The lines are lit up, so we'll go right next to line number 1, calling from
Hi.
Champaign. Good morning.
I have a question about knees again.
Okay.
A friend of mine has had knee surgery, and she has a bad knee, and I also have a bad knee. And her doctor is giving her some shots, which are helping to, I think, replace some of the fluid in the joints.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know if you knew anything about these kind of shots and if they're very useful. My doctor's never suggested anything like that. He just said replacement surgery when you can't stand the pain anymore.
Right. There are basically two kinds of joint injections that people do for arthritic joints. The first people are fairly familiar with, and that's a cortisone injection with the idea that you're going to try and quiet down some inflammatory changes in the joint, and then the joint will then be more comfortable for a period of time, anywhere from weeks to months. The second approach that you mentioned is there are some commercially available substances that can be injected into the joint. They're sort of a thick, viscous fluid, and the idea is that they're going to supplement the amount of joint fluid that is present. In many instances, the lack of normal lubricating joint fluid causes more wear and tear within the joint, and the idea here is that if you replace that you may make the knee more comfortable. This is considered, again, a short-term attempt to make the knee more comfortable. It's not thought to be a long-term cure for the arthritic process in the knee. But for many people who, for a variety of reasons, may be putting off some type of surgical intervention, if it's successful, it will buy them some time, in many instances a number of months, and is not an unreasonable thing to try before giving consideration to surgery. As your physician mentioned, what really drives surgery is ultimately pain that you basically state is intolerable. I can't live like this anymore. I've tried everything else, and you know, I'm ready to have my joint replaced. But other than pain that you can't live with, there really is no other reason to replace a joint.
Right. But the shots to replace or to help lubricate the joint, so to speak, they can be beneficial.
Yes. For some individuals, they've gotten a very good response to it. On the other hand, just like with everything else, there are individuals who've taken the injections and really not gotten much benefit from it. But it's certainly a very reasonable thing. I would put it on my list of things to try prior to surgery.
3 minutes left to talk with Dr. Jeff Swearingen this morning. We have two phone calls to get in that time frame. Line two calling in from Champaign this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. And yourself?
Oh, I'm hanging in there.
Your question for Dr. Jeff?
Sure. I have, for the past 6 weeks or so, been doing cardio and strength training. And the world of strength training is a scary world when it comes to information. There's so much misinformation out there, and I'm trying to supplement myself as best I can to support, you know, strength gains and to support weight loss. And so I was wondering specifically on the topic of thermogenics, on, you know, quote-unquote weight loss pills, and the things that they're supposed to basically just, increase your cardiovascular system, get your body sort of working more to sort of get fat loss going more. I wondered what you thought about those or other kind of supplements that usually go hand in hand with strength training.
I don't recommend any type of pills for patients, you know, doing weight loss, whether that's with, you know, cardiovascular training or weight training. There really aren't any studies that have shown any long-term substantial benefit to any type of weight loss pill. As you refer to some of the things in increasing metabolism, you're basically taking essentially an overdose of Sudafed in an attempt of ramping up your body's metabolism. In the short term, and I mean very, very short term, a few days to a week or two, you're going to get you may see some brief benefit from that, but that is not sustainable over the long run, and there are lots of potentially bad side effects to taking those kinds of medications on an ongoing basis. So I would not recommend it.
Speaking of brief, we've got 1 minute left for a 10-second question from Bloomington on line three and a 30-second answer, Dr. Jeff.
This is a very important question. We've been giving our children vaccinations since 1988, that contain a mercury preservative base, which is correlated with autism and other neurological disorders. Could you please comment?
That actually was just the subject of a very large and exhaustive review, and there has been no evidence that mercury preservatives in any of the immunizations have been associated with autism.
All up, all done. Thanks you much this morning. We've been talking with Dr. Jeff Swearingen of Carl Clinic, a family practitioner. We appreciate it, Dr. Jeff. Thanks much.
Todd, my pleasure. Thank you.
It's been fun this morning. I'll join you again tomorrow morning at the 10 o'clock hour when I fill in for David again. I appreciate the time that we've taken today.